Raise your hand if you had it on your college football bingo card that this would be the year that the entire college football community would be rocked by the Ivy League. That's what we're seeing live and in person. Golic and Wingo on ESPN Radio, ESPN News. Jason Fitz in for Trey and Mike Golic, sitting with Mike Golic Jr. We're presented by Progressive Insurance. All guests appear on the show. Penzo, Performance Line, Mike. Obviously, all eyes yesterday were going to be on the Ivy League, trying to figure out what they decide as a conference they're comfortable with as far as playing any sports, and we get the answer of that. We thought that there might be postponement. They might try and find a way to play games. No. In fact, the college football season is gone for the Ivy League. Canceled is the key word. There will not be college football from the Ivy League, and while it's a small domino, it is the first domino we've seen actually fall in the answer of what will happen for college football.
I was saying, we will focus on football, but this is for all fall sports. The Ivies have announced they are ruling out playing all fall sports. They're the first Division I conference to do so because of the coronavirus pandemic. No decision made yet about winter or spring sports in Ivy or whether fall sports could be played in the spring of 2021. But it sounds like for football, you mentioned that word canceled is the one that's coming up, meaning that is gone in this situation. So, I know this is one that on the outside looking in, people are going to look at and say, you know what, it is, you know, it's the Ivy Leagues. It's not the money makers in college football. It's all these things, but it's one of the first important data points that we've gotten in this conversation as it pertains to what's coming up in the fall as we creep closer and closer to Power 5 college football, the rest of these sports having to make some uncomfortable decisions, some of which we're already seeing pop up in the world of big-time Power 5 sports.
Well, let's look at where this decision came from. Robin Harris, the executive director of the Ivy League, was on Spain & Company last night and talked about where this decision came from and where the protocol was justified.
So what the presidents wanted to do was decide what needed to be decided right now. And it's similar to the approaches most of them have taken regarding campus policies, that the campus policies are subject to change based on how the virus changes and how our ability to treat or combat the virus changes. So as campus policies change, then we can modify what's happening in athletics. So if the situation gets better, that will allow more athletic activities and hopefully competition to occur. And conversely, if it were to get worse, then, you know, we might have to go the other way.
She mentioned that a good number of the Ivy League schools have placed restriction on travel for faculty, staff, and students, which includes the athletes and the coaches involved in this. And some also have restrictions for visitors. So all of those would affect the ability to go around and have athletic competition during all of that. And so in this case, and especially at the Ivies, we know the campus side is always going to dictate to the athletic side. That's the dynamic there. And so with all of that in mind, they couldn't go forward with this.
Well, and let's be real about what's at stake in some of these conversations. Myra Metcalf pointed out yesterday on Twitter, you know, when you talk about Harvard and Yale and Princeton, you're talking about schools that combine to get about $11 million each in generated revenue from college football. That's a stark difference from the close to $150 million that Ohio State generates. So let's be real about how these decisions are being made. We'd be lying to the world to say that money isn't a driving factor in it. Money, obviously, a much different conversation for the Ivy League schools than it is for the Power 5 schools as they try and figure out how they're going to move forward.
And I think this is the perfect thing to underscore what we're hearing in a lot of the rest of college football is, well, we got to do this. Jim Harbaugh came out yesterday, Michigan's head football coach, and one of the things you heard him say was, I'm paraphrasing some, but I'm pretty sure the phrase is, we got to do this. He said, COVID-19 is part of our society. It's not something that was caused by sports or will be made worse by sports, which I don't think is a claim that he can back up when it comes to can be made worse by in all of this, because it depends on what your then floating definition of worse is. But got to play. The Ivy showed you, we don't got to do anything intrinsically, not for the reasons that people are going to bring up, because they've worked so hard to get to this point, because athletics are important to them. No, this is a dollars and cents type thing. We got to do this because, as we're seeing out on the West Coast with Stanford right now, there are athletic departments all around the Power Five that have been punching up, that have been trying to overextend themselves and write checks that it only looks like they can cash based on the strength of Power Five football in a lot of senses. And we're seeing, and I'd sadly imagine going to see more examples of that not being the case.
Well, and I've gone back and forth on this issue so many times. Will there be college football? I get asked all the time, are we going to have college football in the fall? And if you'd asked me a few months ago, I said squarely, no, I didn't think it was going to be safe. And then the economics article came out on ESPN.com that sort of broke down some of the money issues and the roughly $65 million lost per school, and the fact that less than half of all of the FBS schools across the country have reserves to handle those sorts of losses. And that shook me when I read it. I mean, there was this moment when I stepped back and I thought, wow, I mean, should we have college football? No, I don't think we should. Will we have college football? I don't understand how the sport sustains. I don't understand how college athletics sustain economically without college football. So when Harbaugh says we have to have it, you're right. I just want transparency in that. Like, don't try and make it like you're altruistic and you're suddenly the beacon of light in a dark, dark world for giving us college football. We got to have it, because if we don't have college football this year, I don't know who bails out college sports, but somebody will have to.
Bobby Carpenter, our ESPN NFL analyst, was actually on Freddie and Fitzsimmons, former Ohio State great, and brought up what happens if we have no football.
College athletics is a single-income family, and football is that single income. And, you know, talking to some people at Ohio State and going through it, I mean, football accounts for really $150 to $160 million, really the entire budget. So you wipe that out, there's not going to be any sports the rest of the year. Like, and that just isn't Ohio State. Ohio State's similar to Stanford. They had 36 varsity sports. And so if you eliminate that, like, there's not going to be any sports the rest of the year. And if that's happening at places like Ohio State and Stanford, it's going to be happening definitely at places that aren't as financially solvent as some of these big Power 5 schools.
Golic and Wingo here on ESPN Radio, Mike Golic Jr. and Jason Fitz. Stanford, that he mentions there, and we've mentioned a couple times, it's worth noting, announced yesterday that it was going to cut 11 varsity sports, citing the pandemic as a breaking point. They had one of the largest athletic departments, 36 varsity sports, on their payroll and all this, and said, quote, "After considering the effects of this model, we determined that our operating varsity athletic programs in this manner would be antithetical to Stanford's values and our determination to be excellent in all that we do." Now, they're going to still honor the scholarships of all the athletes, honor the contracts of all the coaches, but a school with a $23 plus billion endowment is doing all of this. And that's what people are looking at and going, oh, bleep, we might see more of this.
Well, and again, I'll go back to the article that ESPN.com had that Schlabaugh wrote, that quoted a survey that said, right now, according to a survey of more than 100 athletic directors, only 41% of Power 5 schools and 26% of Group of 5 schools have reserves that will allow them to stay in business without any sort of college football revenue. So you start thinking about that. I mean, that's why this is a landscape changing decision in my mind with the Ivy League. That being said, Greg Sankey, SEC commissioner, made it clear on Freddie and Fitzsimmons last night that the Ivy League is not the SEC.
I don't think that the announcement today is any inflection point for decision making. Now, when you look at what's happening from the trend line with virus testing, with hospitalizations, with supplies and treatments, those are the real inflection points for us.
Which this is in response to, so it is something to keep an eye on here. And we'll get to more comments from Greg Sankey later, where he even addresses the idea of the spring football season in a way that should remind you, if Power 5 commissioners are already reckoning with and potentially discussing behind closed doors the things that it would take to get there, it's a much more real option than we've all made it out to be in recent weeks.
That's an interesting point, and something I talked to Heather Dinich about a little bit yesterday on First Take, Your Take. You know, the NFL doesn't seem to want to play nice right now to moving the draft. And if they don't want to play nice to moving the draft, how does that affect college football moving into the spring? And Heather seems to think that it has a high effect on it, that they want partnership with the NFL if they're going to move that. There are so many complications. I'm not saying it can't happen, but the concept of moving it to spring, there are so many complications to it. I thought Harvard would be the one, or the Ivy League, I should say, would be the ones that opened that door. I expected to get an announcement that they were looking at postponement. The fact that the word cancel sits in the football portion of it was what surprised me, because to me, I thought spring was the real option.
And I think there's a pros and cons list we can do for this that kind of underscores the very clear things at stake and the very clear benefits, because despite all the complications, when we look at this, the financials that are going to make this decision may actually be better served in the spring.
Look at that. Mike Olick Jr. going to break it down. He'll figure out. We've got a lot to break down on this. Obviously, a lot to get to it. But coming up, a double down and then an apology. What is Steven Jackson doing? It's an ever turning. It's like As the World Turns there. That's next. But first.
If you are in our business, or if you are in the public eye, or if you are one of these people that your life, even though you might not recognize it, goes with the ebb and flow of what social media is, you are never going to find peace with what the mission is.
He's undermined his own previous good work with this garbage, and it's garbage.
The problem is no one is getting to Steven Jackson. Before you're going to say something, vet it out.
Simple advice that feels difficult to take. Before you say something, vet it out. But I think it's more important than ever that everybody with the platform take the time to have the self-awareness to do it. And yet again, we're seeing head-scratching moments where I'm wondering exactly what Steven Jackson is thinking and how he's handling this moment. It's Golic and Wingo, ESPN Radio, ESPN News, Jason Fitz, and for Trey. Trey Wingo and Mike Golic sitting with Mike Golic Jr. We're presented by Progressive Insurance. Obviously, a lot of conversation over the last couple of days about DeSean Jackson and his comments on social media, posting a quote that's been appropriately attributed to Hitler, but it was an anti-Semitic post in and of itself. And from that, we've seen an apology from DeSean Jackson. Steven Jackson, however, has been very vocal all the way up to yesterday afternoon, vocal in his defense of DeSean and vocal in his defense of what DeSean is trying to communicate. Well, that took a little bit of a turn when Steven Jackson decided to apologize. He went on CNN and he apologized for the way he's been essentially handling this. He tried to clarify first what he agreed with DeSean about in his apology.
Nobody can find a video or article of me saying I hate anybody. I own something that says love for all who have love for all. I stand on that. In 42 years, you can't say I approach any race or I stand different. No, I don't support any of that. Maybe I could have been more clear of what I thought DeSean was correct about, but I didn't feel the need to go into a conversation that me and him had about how they was treating him and Riley Cooper. I could have changed those words, but the people that know me, my Jewish friends that I talked to today, they know that the last thing I was spewing was to defend Hitler or any other post. That's why I didn't speak on Hitler or even speak on his post. I spoke on exactly what I agreed with, and they was handling him different than they was handling Cooper. That's the end of it. They can twist it how they want, but that's exactly what it is. I don't hate nobody.
So, Mike, I want to be clear. I'm not trying to twist anything he said into any representation that he hates anybody. However, you look at what he said in the moment and going in and using phrases like they all, when he was asked in an interview about the Jewish community and saying they all own the banks. I mean, when you start using phrases like they all, and you're talking about a group of people and you're perpetuating a stereotype, at some point you have to answer for that in the society we're in. And that's exactly what he did.
Yeah, he was asked by the person he's on with. The point is, you did not just say to me that the Jews are not trying to divide the black community. Jackson said, you know that for a fact. You know who the Rothschilds are. They own all the banks. Jackson then said, I haven't said one thing that's untrue yet. And so when you start getting into all these things, they're all the things that lead to the bigoted conspiracy theories that float around the internet that fuel all of these anti-Semitic behaviors, actions, and words. Like, that's why it becomes problematic and dangerous when you have someone like Steven Jackson, who has done so much good in other areas that so many people trust, saying these things in public.
And that's such a difficult part of it, because we've heard Steven Jackson associated with George Floyd so much over the course of the last, month and a half, right? And there's been a lot of good to that. The problem is, when these moments come out, we've got to figure out how to deal with it in a way that doesn't devalue everything about a person, doesn't devalue everything about a person's message, but still at least puts it at the feet of that person to grow from it. I think my issue with the apology even yesterday from Steven Jackson was he used words like maybe I used the wrong words. Maybe No, it's not a maybe. You did use the wrong words. And he came in and did the vaunted thing we all know not to do. He came into his apology and said, well, my Jewish friends. I mean, when you start talking about it in that way, you've put walls up to the people you're communicating to, because those phrases used that way feel very racially charged, very anti-Semitic, no matter what group they're going against. When you start to defend with my friends or use phrases like they all, you put people on edge to what your message really is. He's got to see that that's what he's doing.
Well, it's a poor defense for what he's being asked to apologize for, because we hear the I have a black friend defense used all the time in these things. And the problem is, in this instance, it's great that you're checking on the Jewish people in your life that you know, the black people in your life that you know, to get feedback and to talk with them, because you've got a relationship where you can have conversations that lead to growth. The problem in this situation, again, is Steven Jackson checking in with his Jewish friends is a fine thing to do, but it doesn't account for everyone else that he was talking to. Like, it wasn't a private conversation that he was having with some of his Jewish friends where he said something messed up and they checked him on it. It was a very public conversation that other people were listening to, and that's the difficult part, is that this could potentially influence anyone else's thinking here when the speech that we heard was clearly bigoted. Like, there is very little parsing to do with all that. But that's the tough part, is now that's why these conversations become so hard, because you heard it there. That was defensive posture. That was, I'm being attacked, and so instead of apologizing and saying we're going to move forward, it was an apology, but you guys aren't going to get me like that. And that's why all of these conversations are so hard, and why all of this takes so long. It's because anytime we point out and say, well, here is one thing that we would like you to do better, we saw this spot, and that's not the way, man. And we can all agree, that's not the way. And we need you to learn from this. We would like you to learn from this. And we'd like to help. Most of us would like to give people the opportunity to learn from these things. But then it becomes, your criticism of one thing that I've done is now an attack in my mind on all of my character and everything I've built. And you kind of heard that woven into the response. And that's why all this becomes so tough, because people just immediately get in that defensive posture, and one hit ends up rattling the whole core.
Golic and Wingo on ESPN Radio, ESPN News, Jason Fitz, Mike Golic Jr. Mike, that's a really good point. And, you know, when you start talking about the way communication is received, there's consequence to it in a couple of different ways. Number one, as you said, there are people that are going to read or hear Steven Jackson's comments, and they're going to use it as their own charge towards some level of hate, right? There's also the other side of it, of now there's a whole group of people that have been waiting for a reason to devalue what Steven Jackson says about everything. Stephen A. Mentioned that on First Take about the other consequence here that comes when Steven Jackson so poorly speaks on this issue.
So we've gone from George Floyd getting choked to death, essentially, to statues being torn down, to tweets. But all along the way, when we talk about these things and the symbolic gestures that have come along with it, our ultimate goal of really creating change to address racial oppression, racial inequality, police brutality, and those things, it's fallen by the wayside. Because these kind of things allow folks, particularly white folks, to have something that distracts us from what's really going on. Because I got news for you. Even though you might have a lighter hue, a lighter pigmentation, the Jewish community, not the white community, the Jewish community is the one that had to endure the Holocaust.
I think the difficulty of this is Stephen A's right. People are going to try and use this to invalidate the things that he's done. The difference is, and Bomani Jones brought this up when it came to the subject of people that weren't going to believe NASCAR, were going to battle back against NASCAR, is they're looking for these reasons wherever they're going to come. So there's part of me that said that group was probably never going to be reached anyway. The problem is I don't think you can touch what Steven Jackson's done before this. Everything he did surrounding George Floyd and all the good work he's done. The question is now, can Steven Jackson do the soul searching on this necessary to remain the powerful ally that he can be going forward? And that's what you risk losing potentially if this doesn't change, is what was a powerful ally in the push for all of this going forward.
That's some straight talk wireless, no contracts, no compromise. I want to live in a world where people good all across the board can take these moments and learn from these moments. We've got to find a way where that can happen, and hopefully that can happen from this. Coming up next, the odds were not in baseball's favor, but has that changed? Buster Olney joins us next, but first,
after this word from Odor Eaters. Foot odor throwing off your game? Stick to a winning game plan with Odor Eaters. Features 3 advanced odor and wetness fighters. The lineup provides long-lasting odor control plus more to keep your feet on top of their game. Odor Eaters powder provides outstanding moisture control. Clear drying spray is the MVP in preventing athlete's foot, while insoles work continuously to manage wetness while adding a layer of comfort. Dude, getting old, insoles. No one tells you of how much a part of your life Body Glide and insoles are going to be. And man, the insoles are a game changer.
I love that you're getting old at this point. You know, life's going to get so much easier for you as you just embrace getting old with insoles. This is good. Skolik and Wingo on ESPN Radio and ESPN News, presented by Progressive Insurance. Jason Fitz in for Trey and Mike Golic. Sit with Mike Golic Jr. We'll get to the important baseball conversation in a moment, Mike, but I got to ask you. I mean, we're sitting at your dad's house. I've been here several times during the course of the pandemic, as we've done Golic and Wingo when I've sat in for Trey. I don't know what's happened to my legs today, but Hank and Harry, your beautiful pugs, that during the entirety of the SportsCenter update, they were each on one side just going at my leg like it's a salt lick. I don't know what's happened here, but I think there's something on my leg that apparently they love.
I can tell you there's not anything on your leg. It is complete, you know, gratification for them. It's an oral fixation because they do the same thing. Anytime I wear shorts down here, they come down and they will mercilessly lick your legs until they decide that they're done in all this. And the interesting thing that Jason has encountered this morning is what I've encountered a bunch, and people always notice this, is you got to try and do it with a straight face. Like, we're talking about Steven Jackson's comments that were very, like, anti-Semitic. They were bigoted in the way they were presented. We're debating these apologies, all these things that are very important and heavy subject matter, and you have to try and do that now with a small 9-year-old pug mercilessly licking your legs.
Well, and there's a little bit of a culture shock adjustment to me too, because as everybody knows, I also have several dogs. They are substantially larger. Like, I mean, Clark W. Griswolf is 150 pounds of massive. Like, his tongue is as big as my head, I think. So when Clark actually licks you, it's a very definitive you know thing. For me, I look down, I'm like, what is that tickle? And all of a sudden I realize it's a pug tongue. And, you know, I always see the picture of them hanging out with the pug tongue sticking out. So now we know that apparently they're just, it's out because they wanted to be ready quicker.
Well, and what I always do is you got to give them something else. I always said and always had this argument, if you were getting attacked by like a wolf or something, how are you going about defending it? We actually used to have this argument in the locker room a lot, which is, if you're going to get attacked by a wolf, what are you doing? And the consensus always was, you got to be willing to give something up. Like I always said, you got to be willing to give them an arm, and then you got to go to bat with everything else that you've got. With the pugs, I think about it the same way. If I just give them a hand, something to preoccupy them licking, maybe a little more off camera, it gets them away from my legs where I'm a little more ticklish, and now I'm able to deliver takes more effectively.
I got to worry about thigh day tomorrow. Like, I'm not – thigh day Friday, I am not ready for at any level. Golic and Wingo on ESPN Radio, ESPN News. I know we're efforting Buster only right now, but there is a real question to be – or a real conversation we had about baseball, and we'll get him as soon as we can. But at this point, 66 confirmed positive tests during the intake period. I mean, Mike – there's a spot for me, and this isn't a baseball issue. This is a sports issue right now. I feel like what happens is every time we hear that there's a plan in place, we presume that means the sport is, in fact, going to return. I guess I'm just not going to feel incredibly comfortable with that until we actually see everybody on the field making it happen. I mean, it's been so contentious up to this point with Major League Baseball. It feels like things are already so thin, it will take very little for it to just break apart.
The backdrop in all this that makes it tougher and tougher is we know management and the players are not on the same page going into all this. So anything that comes up, you worry about a flare up there. Like, counter this with what we've seen in the NFL. The NFL and the NFL Players Association just agreed to part of their agreement on coming back and some of the protocol in place. Not anything to do with testing yet, but some of the protocol. So they're checking off boxes along the way. There's been some public disagreement, but not any of the vitriol yet that we've seen from Major League Baseball. And so when I saw that, I said, all right, they're progressing on this one. It's not perfect. It's not where we want it to be yet, and there's still disagreement, but they're progressing, and it's been civil up until this point still. With Major League Baseball, we left that in the past a long time ago, and so the worry is if anything pops up that needs addressing, and it will, like sports' ability to come back is going to be entirely predicated on their ability to patch up problems as they show up. We worry about the ability of Major League Baseball and the players to work together to patch those.
Well, and we'll be joined in a little bit by Taylor Twellman. We'll talk about the return of MLS. But I feel like as every single league comes back, as you mentioned, football, as every single league comes back, all eyes will go over to what's happening and how it's being handled. I mean, if Major League Baseball can come back and have relative success, if MLS can keep these numbers under control, if the NBA can go to the bubble and these things all work, then great. You've got sort of proof positive. But we talked earlier about the Ivy League and how college football is looking at the Ivy League. I believe the NFL is looking at every sports league right now. And where positives may not be enough to calm everybody, negatives are enough to panic everybody. If a league of any sort returns and then can't handle the COVID outbreak on it, I believe that at that point, that becomes an even greater issue that will directly impact the NFL's ability to return.
Well, especially Major League Baseball, because they're going to be traveling like the NFL is. Right. There's no bubble model that helps these two sports. You are going to be out there and you're going to have to work through the problems that come with what was part of shutting the Ivies down for this fall. We got so many restrictions on travel and who can be where and when, it would be very difficult for us to try and operate. Major League Baseball, the NFL, aren't going to operate with those restrictions from the organization, but they're going to have to deal with the public's rules and how that change between now and when things get started up. As cases spike in certain spots, and we've seen a number of those, how does the public laws that go into place around there affect that? Because that's still ultimately what's going to decide a lot of this is, all right, what is local government allowing to happen at that point as things happen? What is the virus now dictating at this point in time? That's always been the case, but I feel like somewhere along the line, as a general public, we lost sight of that idea in a way that sports can't.
Well, and that's why I believe the NFL has been so clear. I mean, if you look at what the NFL has done over the last several months, they haven't given us much in the way of a plan B. They've given us very little information on how they're going to manage traveling and how they're going to manage this virus through the fall. But the one thing that they've been consistent about is every team's going to be able to make their own decisions on who comes in. I mean, yesterday the Ravens announced 14,000 will be the capacity for their stadium. So you start to look across the board and what you have is every team's making their own decisions. I don't believe that's because the NFL wants to empower each owner. I believe that's because the NFL wants to make sure that the onus goes on local government to cancel an NFL season, not on the NFL themselves. Like, they've found who the bad guy can be, and the bad guy can be a particular state that decides they're simply not going to allow football to be played. So, you know, that's the other variable, I think, that's different with the NFL, with everybody else. They are clearly putting the buck on somebody else's palm.
But I think in those instances, they also do it knowing most of those areas, when push comes to shove, are going to do whatever they can to accommodate sports. How quickly did we see at the beginning of all this states like Arizona saying, we're open for business for pro sports, and California, New York, and all these other places following suit quickly on that, because you don't want to be the place that's turning down that level of business.
Well, the question with Major League Baseball, in my mind, that's going to be the real deciding factor is how willing, after all the contentious disagreement we've seen, how willing are players and owners going to be patient with each other and work with each other? Because the thing that, again, hits me every time we see these plans is that the plans are great until you're actually living them out day in and day out. There are going to be so many variables and changes in the way the testing is coming through and the way the results are happening that I wonder if there is a how can we work this out attitude between the players and the owners that will facilitate continual conversation moving forward. Because without that, I don't see how it happens.
We're seeing that play out in the WNBA right now. We saw all of the complaints to begin the bubble stay from videos on the inside of different parts of the experience that were not what the players and athletes believe that they deserved in these spots. And understandably so, when you looked at some of the visuals of some of the laundry rooms, some of the things that they were being fed, all of that. And what did we hear? Kathy Engelbert, the WNBA commissioner, going to work behind the scenes, starting to fix all these problems, addressing these things as they come up. And so you've got to see that give and take. Obviously, the public part of that, probably not something the league was really excited about here. And that's something the NBA's always done really well, which is the players, because they trust Adam Silver, will tend to bring their problems to him instead of putting them out in the public in that way. Maybe the WNBA, in Kathy Engelbert's first year, doesn't have that relationship ironed out just yet. But going forward, we see from her side and from the league side, all right, they're going to bat to try and fix these problems. We talked to LaChyna Robinson on the show yesterday and said the response has been there. And with those things comes from the trust of the relationship you talked about between players and league. That's different across the board.
Which is why I'll continue to look at what's happened in Major League Baseball and say that the difficulties they've faced this year aren't because of just the things that have happened this year. They're because of years of distrust that has been cultivated between the players and Rob Manfred. All right, we'll catch up with Buster next time. In the meantime, we got a lot to get to here, so let's get a little caught up on what's trending.
Let's do it, Bobby. Or Jason.
I'm Jason.
Let's do it, Bobby. All right, friend.
Yeah, is that a movie?
Never seen
quote?
The Waterboy?
Oh, yeah, no, I've seen The Waterboy. It was okay. I saw it one time. It's, you know, The number of times that movies and entertainment quotes become the dividing factor in our friendship. Like, he quotes something and I just look at him blankly and he realizes that means I've never seen it. And movies I've seen 1,000 times, you know, I don't quote properly. Like, I close quote everything. Like, you know what I'm talking about, but I don't have the right quote. Like, you know, it's our fatal flaw in our...
Jason, this is among the many reasons why you would have made a terrible offensive lineman. Terrible offensive lineman. I'll tell you why in a second after we get caught up on what's
and
trending.
Flexible hips? Oh, go ahead. Sorry. Trending.
Among the many reasons why you'd make a terrible offensive lineman. Elena Deledon is still waiting to hear back from the WNBA panel on medical exemption coming up here. The league's independent panel of doctors is going through the protocol right now to see if she'd be medically excused for this season, the Washington Mystics said on Wednesday. Remember, Elena Deledon, the Washington Mystic star, who was the league's most valuable player last year, has battled Lyme disease since 2008, so she'd be potentially at a higher risk for serious illness if she contracted the coronavirus. Her new Washington teammate, Tina Charles, is also waiting for a decision from the panel. Neither player is in Florida with the team, and remember, if they are deemed medically excused for the season, then they would still receive their full salary, and the team wouldn't be able to sign someone else in their place. Certainly more updates on that coming. Meanwhile, Major League Soccer is back's tournament was going on last night, and we saw MLS players unite in a Black Lives Matter tribute. Over 100 black MLS players raised their right fists and took a knee before the MLS is back tournament opener in a show of solidarity with the Black Lives Matter movement. Some players wore t-shirts over their jerseys with the words Black and Proud and Silence is Violence before the match between Orlando City SC and Inter Miami CF. And both teams' starting players, as well as the referees, took a knee just before kickoff. And in the NFL, running back Raheem Mostert requested a trade from the 49ers. Mostert's requested a trade after failing to get the type of contract that he wants, his agent Brett Tesler said in a tweet. Mostert scheduled to get a base salary of $2.575 million this season and is due $2.875 million in 2021 as part of a three-year contract that he signed with the Niners last year. Mostert led the 49ers with 772 rushing yards last season and scored 10 touchdowns. What's Trending is brought to you by Redbox. Redbox has nonstop excitement with new movies and summer blockbusters. Don't miss Becky, an action-packed thriller starring Lulu Wilson, Kevin James, and Joel McHale. Visit Redbox.com for all the ways to watch.
Scola going on ESPN Radio, ESPN News, Jason Fitz, in for Trey and Mike, sit with Mike Golic Jr. All of our guests appear on the Shell Pennzoil Performance Line. I would make a great offensive lineman, by the way. You know, I'm a good teammate. We're good. You know, I communicate well. You know, I'm a buddy in the locker room. Come on. Like, I was born to be a lineman.
You would make a terrible offensive lineman because, A, you have terrible flexibility in your hips, which we already touched on, but you mentioned the inability to quote movie quotes. Jason, when you're a group of fat kids that all hang out together like an offensive line room does, you're large, you're, by most societal standards, overweight, you smell kind of off. You need something to draw people in, and that is the social currency of movie quotes. If you go into any offensive line room in America, most will be able to accurately quote a pretty large pool of movies there and do it in the right context and make it pretty witty, because that's the only chance we have, because all the other things in life that can be appealing, we have taken away in the name of protecting other people in the job. So that is why you'd make a terrible offensive lineman.
I just figured you guys watched a lot of movies because you don't have to do much film study to just walk in front of somebody and push them around, right? Like, it's a pretty brainless job, right?
I am gonna kill you. Yeah. Golic and Wingo's brought to you by Barbasol. Feeling great starts with a great shave, and a great shave starts with Barbasol shaving cream. That's Barbasol shaving cream, an American classic for over 100 years. You're looking good, America. You're shaving with Barbasol. It takes a lot of work to go out there and open up these kind of holes, all right? It takes a lot of work, and if you demean that, I will come across the room and I will strangle you socially. I have long enough reach to socially distance strangle you.
And we all know that I can't outrun anybody, so I don't really stand much of a chance. Raheem Mostert can obviously outrun a lot of people. He wants a new deal. Tough time right now to want a new deal for a running back in general. Tough time to want a new deal for a running back in Kyle Shanahan's offense. Tough. I mean, there's just a million variables to this that feels difficult for a player that wants a new contract and wants to get paid. And then on top of that, we're in a pandemic and we have no idea what the NFL season is going to look like. So it feels like he's just sort of pinched in where he is.
I always understand the sentiment, especially with running backs, because, man, your shelf life is short. Man, you got to strike when the iron's hot. In most instances, the problem is we've rarely seen that rewarded lately. Unless you're Christian McCaffrey, you don't have much of a leg to stand on. Now, with the 49ers, I believe they Matt Breida, they moved on from, and he got dealt somewhere else in this situation. Jarrett McKinnon is still on the roster and has been there, but he hasn't played much in the last two seasons because of a knee injury he suffered. And so the roster might help get him some leverage in this situation. But in general, we looked at that running boom back room last year in a Kyle Shanahan offense where he's going to get the lion's share of the credit, and understandably so because he might be the best play caller in the NFL. We're going to look at that situation, and we talked about it. Their backfield was kind of the running back version of the Legion of Zoom that we see in Kansas City in the receiver group. They had an extremely fast backfield, whether you measure by 40 times or miles per hour, and Kyle Shanahan put them in situations with the way that he schemes up runs, which is so unique, to go out there and win in a way that for most people made it seem like, all right, as long as they've got someone back there, they're going to be able to get production. And with that as the backdrop, I feel like negotiation here is going to be a very difficult thing. Clearly they've said, so I don't know if he'll get his trade wish granted, because I don't know if he's got that kind of leverage, but it's just a tough spot to be in right now for any running back.
Well, and it feels like whatever running back you are, you want to take the step to the next level of pay. And there's a wall of resistance against that, partially positionally, obviously. But again, we're still living in a world where Derrick Henry doesn't have a long-term deal worked out, and we know how much he means to the Titans. So that's not the only long-term deal we still have eyes on. Still nothing with Dak Prescott. We are inching closer, though, to the deadline, because July 15th is the deadline for the franchise tag. If he doesn't sign a long-term deal by July 15th, he can't for the season. He has to play the entirety of the season on the franchise tag that he has right now. So now that we have the monster number in for Mahomes, has your feeling changed at all about whether or not you think Dak is going to lock in long-term before that deadline?
No, I mean, it certainly changed what I think number the Cowboys would have to come up to meet in all of this. It's not going to make it anywhere near or over $40 million. And remember, many moons ago, it seems like already, that was one of those numbers that got floated out, I'd imagine, by the Cowboys side of things. Dak Prescott's asking for $40 million in all this. Dak Prescott's not going to get $40 million in this. But now he can look at Patrick Mahomes beating the top average by $10 million and go, well, you know what? Russell Wilson and that number, all of a sudden, that might be the true floor if it hadn't been already in these negotiations. So I think it changes that, but I still think he's going to end up playing this year on the tag. I think this has put Dallas in a spot now where they were already going to be up against it, where leverage had swung back in Dak's favor, and this only added to it.
What about the length, though? I mean, because that's the other, we keep hearing the reports that the real holdup here is at least largely that the Cowboys want him for 5 years. He wants four. He wants to hit the market again. Well, now the Cowboys can go in and say, look at what Mahomes did. He did a 10-year deal. I mean, you want to talk about longevity and contract. I mean, it feels like if you're the Cowboys, you can at least go in and say, hey, bend with us to 5 years. We're not asking for 10. Give us five instead of four. It feels like maybe they get a little help based on the length of Mahomes' contract.
No, because then Dak Prescott can just go and point to, you know, almost anyone else in any instance in that. Like, we talk about it. We've said that that's why it's all an outlier with Patrick Mahomes. Like, the $45 million average per year is an outlier and not something that Dak can go and turn around and ask for. So at the same time, I don't think the Cowboys are in the position right now, because you're right, logically, it's kind of similar, but the position they're in up against this kind of deadline, knowing on the other side of this, we're either going to have to tag him again at a crazy price or risk letting him hit true free agency. Their backs are much more against the wall. Dak can kind of sit there and be willing to kind of lay in the cut.
I think it's interesting that this will now be the second time in recent football that the best, arguably the best quarterback in the NFL at the time, has taken a very strange contract situation, because Brady took less money for a very long time. And so it sort of put him out of the conversation when you talked about money for quarterbacks. Now you've got Mahomes coming in, taking a 10-year deal that frankly gives him 12 more years. In 12 years, $52 million, were they not to retouch the deal again, a $52 million cap hit in 12 years is nothing compared to where the cap likely will be for a quarterback at that point. So it's funny to me we have a second outlier of a contract.
Yeah, it's so much of it. Like, it took us so long to all go through it because every part of it was unprecedented, banana lands, and trying to predict that far out in the future when you're right. The most recent thing, or the most pressing thing coming up soon, was the new TV money that we had all talked about, and this, how that affected the way the players had done deals and the relationship side of this. Like, we can say the relationship now is in an interesting spot. We've always heard Jerry Jones takes care of his guys. We see people getting paid left and right around here. But this particular relationship, the way this has gone on, I mean, we were talking about this deal in spring of last year, in spring of 2019, and it's taken this long. So I have a feeling the relationship now is nowhere near where it needs to be for something like what we saw with Patrick Mahomes, where both sides loved on each other so much that they were willing to say, all right, we'll kind of meet in the middle on this in a way that everybody wins from.
They both took a huge risk. I mean, the Chiefs take a huge risk that, God forbid, there's an injury situation that causes a decline in play. That's a huge risk. Mahomes takes a risk, even though he gets all the money up front, that he could have made substantially more over the next 12 years. It's what's interesting about it, because they have, what do you know, second time we're talking about this in 30 minutes, mutual respect. It's amazing how mutual respect seems to make negotiation in general a much easier thing to get through. It's a foreign concept to so many people. All right, coming up next, obviously we've talked a lot about the return of sports, but MLS is returning. What can other sports learn from soccer? Taylor Twellman joins us next. Coloco Wingo, ESPN Radio, and ESPN News.